Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Hello.
What's the word?
I want to talk a little bit about time.
I'd like to talk about time, so I'm all ears.
Yeah, I've just been struck by something because, we're just about, 6 months or 6 months and a few weeks since we started.
I was just going to say that, actually. That was my lead-in topic. We just passed 6 months.
Yeah. Why do we even have these phone calls if we're thinking the same thing?
We can just do the neural. We can do the neural mashup and let AI figure it out. Right? That's funny.
Yeah, but one of the things I've noticed is that time has sort of slowed down. There's a slowing down, and just as a lead thought on this, that I think that when you have to travel by yourself, and it takes time. You want to get through that time very, very quickly. In other words, if you're flying somewhere, you have to do the whole routine.
Real time. Yeah, you've got to move your physical body.
Yeah, but it really isn't creative time because you have to be focused on an activity which is very repetitive. And in part of your mind, it's kind of an unpleasant, it's a sacrifice that you're having to make. And I think we try to get through sacrifices really fast. And so we speed up time to get to the, the important part of why we're traveling in the first place. It's a meeting that's ahead in the future, and we want to get there as fast as possible. And we want we kind of want to minimize our consciousness. So we can get to that. But with the Zoom, you're doing what you're doing and you're enjoying it. And then you look at your watch and you say, oh, in 2 minutes, I've got a Zoom call.
Yeah.
And I used my last two Jackson time periods before I actually dialed on to get on this call to get about 3 or 4 important things done. And so that was very, very useful time. And now here we are. I was in Toronto, but now we're here.
Yeah, we're here. We're in Cloudlandia together.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're saying that, and you really, I don't know how long, as long as I've known you, you've been using your car service as a time travel device, because that's the only thing you had to worry about was getting in the car at a certain time, and you have that other time back, the time in between, how long it takes to get to wherever you're going. That must be an
interesting 30 years.
Bennington.
I would say most of my travel for 30 years. Most of my travel for 30 years has been having a driver, a limousine driver, to actually do that.
And either that or
I usually read. I usually read. When I'm doing that, and novels are really good because it's a story. So you're picking up the story when you get in the car, and then you move along the story. And depending on the driver, I'll talk or I won't talk. Uh-huh. But But what about the slowing down time? It's an interesting thing, but it hadn't struck me because I was just reviewing the last 6 months, and I said, "Boy, I sure got a lot done during that 6 months." But it seemed like almost a single experience.
Yes, it reads as one. That's the thing that our brains. I learned that why time seems to move faster as we get older is because there's less and less variety. Like when you're thinking about time in your teens and 20s, it's constantly new. You're in new places. You've got your first day at college, your first, your dorm room, then you're in a new place and then new friends. And then you join the military and you were in a new place there and you come. So you've got all these experiences that when your mind looks back on them, those are all like, if you look at them as recorded, sound waves, if you see the peaks and valleys of activity, those are all new experiences that are registering. But once you get into a situation where you're living in the house you're in and you're driving to the same office and you see the same people and you're doing the same thing largely, that all reads to your brain as one thing. So it looks back. Mm-hmm. There's no friction. There's no outstanding peaks or valleys to mark it. Like I've heard you talked about, of all the workshops that you've done, there's probably a handful that would stand out and you can recall them instantly, like the September 11th workshop. Because that, of all the workshops that you've done in Chicago in that room, that was an outlier. And there's something unique about that. Now, all of the other workshops all kind of blend into each other. And I imagine if somebody had a baby in a workshop or somebody had, a medical emergency or something happened that caused a peak on the Richter scale of your memory of it, that would stand out as an outlier. But the others all blend into one because there's not much variety in it.
Although there is more variety in a Zoom workshop than in an in-person workshop.
That could be. And now we look at it at the very first one.
No, and the reason is that generally speaking, in the in-person workshops, when there's a breakout group,
yes,
I take a break. I'll go and talk to the team or I'll do something.
Yeah.
But in every Zoom workshop since the very first in March, and those were short two hour mini workshops, I've been in every single breakout group. I haven't missed a single breakout group. And it's like Christmas morning every time you go into a breakout group because it's
because you never know who. Yes.
But I don't know who's under my tree this time.
And, right.
And in a full one, 6 hours, there's five breakout groups. And I meet and talk with a great number of individuals that in an in-person workshop, I wouldn't necessarily listen to them and talk to them and interchange with them. And it's 20 minutes. It's five times 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But I get a real feel for people that I didn't know. I remember their stories. I remember what they're working on.
Yeah.
And then when I go back into the full session, I can get them to talk about something they said in the breakout session. And that becomes, a valuable resource in the larger groups. And so my standpoint is that there's a lot more novelty packed into Cloudlandia than there is in the mainland.
Yes, and a lot less friction.
Somebody said that movies are like real life with all the boring stuff taken out. Well, Cloudlandia is like it's like real life sharpened to a finer edge.
I agree with that 100%. Because yes, you can be you can still have all the other we've basically cut out all that middle stuff. So it's so great. And that's life compacting on us like that. Everything is, that's one of the greatest things is this, let's call that convenience too. If I think you can put it on that things are getting so much more, every little bastion of time where we are inefficient in it, where there's something that's causing on it. Like, you remember, it wasn't too long ago, Dan, that if you wanted to watch a specific show on television, you had to show up in front of the television at that time. Right. Yeah. And now that's unthinkable that you're yes. going to, you know, and it's not even now, especially things like the, you know, debates or, you know, things that stretch on. Now, if you miss it synchronously within hours, somebody's going to have, I thought about this with Elon Musk, did the Neuralink demonstration press conference. Mm-hmm. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so he, you know, he's, they've yeah, installed.
I know what he's attempting to do, but I didn't see the actual event, no.
So they have installed these Neuralinks in some pigs to see the, you know, show the efficacy of it, kind of thing. But it was an hour and a bit, and there were technical difficulties and so, you know, with the pigs, getting the pigs out on time. But then somebody, within hours, had the 14 minutes that matter of the entire the entire thing mm-hmm. in 14 minutes. And that somebody do that with the debates, the entire debate in 14 minutes or whatever. Yeah. We're very efficiently eliminating dead time or wasted time. I think that's something
you just triggered something one of the things that I really notice is that wasting time on Cloudlandia is a no-no. In other words, don't use up people's Cloudlandia time with boring, meaningless stuff.
Right. Yes. Yes, it's all from concentrate. That's the great part of it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So here's the thing. I'm looking also at the bigger world, and I estimate, you know, that probably Zoom is across the 400 million daily users now. You know, I haven't checked the numbers, but they were at 375 2 months ago, and I suspect they probably pulled in another, another 25 million in the last 2 months. But with that, I would say that the work that's being done is of a higher quality than mainline work.
Oh yeah. Well, they're cutting out all of the they're cutting out all the inefficient hours of stuff. You know, like, I mean, you mm-hmm. think about a job, like having a workforce in an office. There's a lot of inefficiency in that, in terms mm-hmm. of both the time. If you take the time impact of somebody having a job that they have to travel to get to. So let's say they're traveling 30 minutes commute to work, that the impact of that, they've got to get up, early enough to shower and prepare themselves and have breakfast or work out or do whatever they need to do to then start the commute to get to work. And then there's the onboarding or on ramping kind of time of, you know, seeing everybody and getting coffee and, you know, checking mm-hmm. their mail and getting settled. And then there's a period of time where they're actually doing the work that they do. And then it's lunchtime. And then there's some, you know, on ramp getting back and maybe some interruptions and meetings and things that are less than efficient. And then it's quitting time again, right? And so mm-hmm. this allowing it to be just you know, starting right at the time is pretty, there's a lot to it.
Yeah. It's very interesting. One thing that I've introduced into all my meetings, however, is to soften the beginning of a Zoom session. So the way our workshops work, we have a pre-meeting with the team a half hour before the scheduled workshop. Okay. And we have a host for each of the workshops, the person who is actually controlling the Zoom part of the of the event. And I said, if you say that the meeting is going to start at 9:30, let people come in from 9:20 onwards.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so that you can chat with people because you don't see them these days. You don't actually interact with them in the cafe.
Well, I actually love that about Gino Wickman's idea of the meetings like that. If they start at 10 a.m., that the actual meeting, you know, the first 10 minutes is open kind of chatting and things like that. But it starts precisely at 10:10 and it ends at exactly 11 a.m.
Yeah. So we just do it the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we just do the opposite. We have 10 minutes of chat time before, but then the meeting actually starts at the appointed time. So we're doing more or less the same thing. It's just, I just noticed in the office that, when we do these type of meetings, either in Chicago or Toronto, which are my main two sites, is that in the cafe, the meetings will be in the cafe, and people will show up 15 minutes early, 10 minutes early.
Yeah, I always do,
And so why not just hang out and just chat?
Yeah.
Then there's this, it's not this abrupt, it's not like the start of an Olympic sprint or something. And the same thing I do with the clients. So we get our business, if we start promptly at 9:30, the actual getting ready for the workshop, we're usually finished by 10 minutes to the hour. And I said, are there any clients in the do they call it? The waiting room?
Exactly. I think so. The waiting room. Yep.
The waiting room. I said, bring them in. Let them come in. I said, they showed up early. Give them a reward for showing up early, and we'll just, chat with them.
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny because it's got some of its real world quality to it, because I had somebody who was just really wound up about the riots that are going on, and he came and he expressed himself to me.
Yes.
Because I was on, and it was jarring to our team. It was very jarring to our team, and I didn't put any logs on his fire. I didn't add any accelerant to his fire, but we've done it. We've done it 20 times, and there was this one odd thing that happened, and it hasn't repeated it. Somebody said, well, we shouldn't bring them in. I said, that's one on the negative side for you. Think of all the positives. I said, think of the other things we found out about people, and their wife had a baby the day before. All sorts of good news. I said, you're just zeroing in on this one thing as the reason why we shouldn't do it. I said, that's what government bureaucrats do. And I said, if there's one instant of some negative, then we make a law that forbids the activity for everybody else. I said, here, I'll give you an example. What would you have to do to your thinking so that if someone did that, it wouldn't bother you?
Yeah. That's a better way to think about it, isn't it?
I find it easier to do your thinking. Yeah. Dean, I'll ask you a serious question. Have you found it easier to change yourself than to change the world?
Oh, absolutely. This is, you know, Jamie Smart, a good friend, he wrote a book called Clarity. And it's one of those books that is, you know, absolutely, you read it and you get the insight. And it's, you know, I guess you could sum it up by saying that 100% of our emotional state and our experience that we have is 100% created from the inside out, not from the outside in. And that's a, you know, that's really, it's fascinating when you can kind of detach yourself from it and you realize that I'm creating this state that I'm in because I take the data or the input and I run it through my special effects department, which turn it into this emotional state. And I'm in complete control of the studio. You know, I can turn it into whatever I want.
Yeah, whether you admit it or not.
Right.
You know, I mean, the whole point is that you can be, if you choose to be, you can be 100% responsible for your emotional reactions. I mean,
I had, you know, I'll tell you,
it's a skill. It's a skill. It's a skill to be. Yeah.
I'll give you a perfect example of this. I sat in this exact room that I'm in right here. Little reading room, and I've got two great leather club chairs, and I sit in one to do the podcast, but sitting in the other chair across here from me was Homer McDonald, who is the gentleman Stop Your Divorce book with.
Yeah.
And Homer, we recorded an audio program, and I was going to play the advocate of the person who's being left, and I was going to, you know, get Homer's answers for things. And in the first 6 minutes of this program, he completely dismantled it. So I was saying how, you know, that imagine that, you know, my wife said she doesn't love me anymore. She wants to get a divorce. And he says, well, how are you feeling about that? And I said, well, I'd imagine, you know, I'd be very upset about that. And I would be, you know, I want to do everything I can to get her back. He said, okay, well, imagine that I'm saying to you right now, I guarantee you, we're going to get her back. And within 30 days, she's going to be back and in a loving relationship with you, and she's going to be sort of better than it ever was. And I was saying, wow, that sounds great. He says, can you really, do you believe that? Can you imagine that? And how are you feeling now? And I would say, well, I feel great. He goes, so it, you know, nothing's changed about the situation. It's just the way that you think about it. And now you're feeling great. So you can feel great.
Yeah.
How you think about it. And I thought, man, I fell for that sink line and hook, line, and sinker, or whatever they say. And you just realize he just like hammered that home that, you know, nothing's changed and you feel great. So it's
here's the thing though, the question, the proposition that he offered you to think about a month from now and everything's great and everything's back. When you're in the emotion you are, you can't do that type of thinking for yourself generally.
But you can under guidance, I guess. Yeah.
You can under guidance, and that's really why we're so useful to each other, because the one not feeling the emotion can think more clearly. The one who is not in the situation themselves can bring other dimensions into the conversation more than the person who's fixated. Well, I'll give you an example, and it happened politically. It happened over the last 2 days that both parties in the election going towards November had a clear agenda of what all the, you know, the discussion points were going to be, the argument points, the debating points, and what the commercials were going to be about, and everything like that. And then a Supreme Court justice dies on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And everything changed. Everything changed within about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Everything changed because the election is really about whether the person who's president and, you know, the Senate and the, you know, the Congress are going to stay the way they are right now, or whether, you know, there's going to be a fundamental change. But the furthest future that they really could see was November 4th, the election being on November 3rd. So it was all about mm-hmm. November 4th. But Supreme Court justices go for 30 years. And and so all of a sudden, the issues at stake weren't November 4th. They were the next 30 years. So nobody was thinking 30 years. Nobody was thinking 30. The entire context. So what you'll see going forward, nobody's going to be talking about whether the pandemic was handled really right or wrong or, you know, what the Russians are doing or what the Chinese are doing. It's about who's going to fill that Supreme Court position, because this is it's the greatest job in the world, because once you have it, you can have it for as long as you want it. And there's only, you know, it's not an abundant position. There's a limited number of, there's a limited number of justices.
Yeah.
And and they affect everything. They affect everything and everything. But I was just amazed at the, because I, you know, I checked the news sites on the internet, and all talk of everything they'd been talking to on Friday morning was completely changed by Saturday morning.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, same thing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Same thing. Yeah.
And it's an interest. They're now the debate then comes to how they were pressuring Obama when there was 11 months left in his term when the last vacancy came. And they were pressuring to say, well, really, that's got to be left for the incoming president's, job. And now it's funny that, you know, there's less than a couple of months left, or 4 months, I guess, and they're going to rush to try and get it filled here. It's funny how all the perspective changes, you know.
Yeah. The only thing about that, if the other party was in charge, they'd do the same thing.
You know, exactly. Like, that's what I mean. That's the whole thing. And so that was the point of it, is that no matter what, you're going to argue whatever is on your side.
Yeah, I mean, you can be idealistic, except if you have a deadline.
Mm-hmm. I think you're on to something, though, about this time. Because I've learned there's something that you can now, literally get just what you need exactly when you need it in almost every situation now, what you need, no inefficiencies of that. There's, I think I shared with you last time that I'm noticing now that what we're getting to is in a marketplace type of environment where everything is on tap. It's like the unlimited who's of whatever you need on just when you need it. You know, like I look at, they're taking out the inefficiencies now. I think I mentioned the design capabilities the execution, we don't use them for creative stuff as much. We do that stuff in-house, but the design execution, like switching things out or compiling things, or we have a lot of our authors that we do with 90 minute books. We create these digital marketing packs that have the three-dimensional books and pictures of the books and the postcard and all the stuff. But once the cover of the book, we do all the covers and everything internally. But once those assets are created, then filling those into templates is something that, you know, we can get done with a design service. And but we, you know, it's amazing the model now. I think we pay like $400 a month or under $400 a month for unlimited design, or, you know, just this constant on tap. You stack up all of your, you can have unlimited requests kind of thing, but they do one at a time basically. And if you do it efficiently, it's kind of like when Netflix was getting started with the DVD delivery. You know, there was if you did it right, you know, you could have you know, you could order a two DVD at a time subscription. And if you ordered one and you watched it at night and then you put it in the mail the very first thing next morning, you could get back the next one, you know, within a couple of days.
Yeah, I remember that. And then it was six for a month or something like
that.
Yeah,
and that was the thing.
They expanded the number of things. And I remember Richard Rossi was always the, you know, he was very much the pathfinder for Explorer and Pathfinder for a lot of people. And, you know, he was the first one that I remember into Uber. He was the first person into Zoom. Or not Zoom, but Kindle. He was the first person into Kindle. And then, of course, Amazon itself just started with Kindle. You know, they started with one product, and everybody said, gee, boy, it's so great getting your books just like that. Why couldn't you get other things just like that? And then they just kept feeding that, you know, that.
Well, that was all that those. That's what I was saying when we first talking about the cascading asymptotes, you know, that the capability to digitize and distribute text was first. So that's why the Kindle came first, and then the iPod, and then YouTube, and then streaming. That's how it all happened as the capabilities changed. And now with, you know, 5G, it's instant, always on at all times everywhere. That's a really interesting place to come from.
Yeah,
but we're not. But fundamentally, we're not getting any more time.
Well, that's an interesting topic. Whether time is actually a quantitative thing or a qualitative thing,
right?
You know, like, you know, my sense is that my quality of time is quite a bit greater than 6 months ago.
Yes. I agree, yeah. And our access to things. What I was thinking about this morning and wanted to have a little talk about today is this, that the capability to do bigger and bigger whats with less effort, like with the right, it's almost like with the right lever, I could move the world. With the right Hula decks, I can move any what is a possibility with the right Hula decks lever, you know? And that really the vision, when we talk about the vision, capabilities, and reach, is the vision is where the what comes from here. And being able to, you know, take that vision through the capabilities and reach to get it out there. That's really where I'm most excited to be a quick start and most excited to be thinking that way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting. And, you know, I haven't been thinking this, except it's been brought up a lot in workshops over the last at last month or so. The difference between wanting what you need and wanting what you want, And I think that that's actually a divider of how you experience time. I think that wanting what you need is always a little bit of a nervous game. And part of the reason is you're comparing yourself against other people.
Yeah.
My sense is the world of need is a comparison. It's a competitive world, you know, you have the constant feeling that you're falling behind or you're being left out and everything. Wanting what you want is completely generated from the inside. You get an idea of creating something that doesn't exist yet. And since it doesn't exist yet, there are no hows to actually get there.
Okay? Right.
And what it does is switches your mind to whose. Okay.
Yes.
And you're saying, you know, I wonder if I talk to so-and-so and kind of talk to them about what they're doing. Maybe they could add something, you know, tell me about some of the hows that could actually happen, because quite frankly, I don't actually know how to get there. I don't really know how to get there, you know? And my sense is wanting what you want naturally favors having who's do it. Wanting what you need naturally favors that it's your howing that's going to.
See, I like this approach is that this is what I think that when we're seeking capabilities, like the what's possible, when you're exposing yourself to idea to things that are capabilities that people have, that can spur the creativity. Like there's so much right now that is available and possible that if you had the right vision for it, that there's you know, never ending possibility. I just discovered, I'd heard this before, but that seeking is a core emotion. Have you ever heard that about?
I can certainly relate to that thought.
And it's a dopamine creator that sense of elation and enthusiasm and excitement as you're seeking, and you know your mind is like on fire with possibilities when you're exposed to new things. That is a that's how I live a lot of my life. I think that, and then you realize that actually now, when you where the energy drop of that is when you run into that wall of, I don't know how to do this now. You know, and that to keep that energy by seeking and looking for these capabilities, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're applying
all those capabilities all those capabilities out there are meaningless if you don't have a project.
Yes. Yeah. And a project.
Yeah.
Manager.
I mean, the vast majority, you know, and we have been having lots of conversations, and Babs and I have been having lots of conversations with Joe Polish, who's taking on a project that would be unthinkable. You know, if you had known Joe, you've known Joe, I think probably, I don't know, as long as I have. Mine goes back 23 years.
Yeah,
and,
I know, probably a little
longer. The project which he has publicly announced, so it's not, we're not trading on inside information here, is that he's going to take a one-year sabbatical starting January 1st. Next thing. And the thing that I find really interesting is that he's talking to other people who are super busy, and their response to Joe, as he's reported them to us, is that they say, I wouldn't even know how to st- uh, I wouldn't even know how to think about what you're just telling me. In other words, you're going to take a, and you're going to cut off all, you know, your normal activities and, you know, and you're, to a certain extent, it's going to mean like a digital diet, you know, it includes it. And my sense is it'll get better quarter by quarter, you know, that, he'll learn what sabbaticaling actually means. In other words, sabbaticaling is kind of a skill, and he's and you know he's engaging himself in the mastery of a skill, which he hasn't done before, and now he's going to do it. And at the end of a year, he's going to have this as a further skill to go forward. And so my sense, you know, and because I've been on a diet of another sort, and I'm now in my 26th month, I'm just coming up on, actually, I think it's 26th month, right about now, but I haven't watched any television. Actually, I haven't watched any television, set television. In other words, turning on the television. I haven't done any of that. And I sort of shield my eyes when I walk through airport, airport lobbies and everything else. I can't stop and watch it at all.
So well, anyway, you should probably exercise the gaskets on the television just to make sure that it's not corroding.
Yeah.
Somebody should.
So, well, I have to tell you, the set we have actually requires about four things to get what you want, and I don't remember
perfect.
Four things are.
So, there we go.
So I've disenabled myself rather than the technology. And but it's really, really interesting because I notice my preference for reading has really come back because even when I go on the internet, I'm looking for articles, which in some cases take 5 or 10 minutes to read.
Yeah.
And so I'm not watching television like reporting. I'm going after, you know, sort of 2 or 3 page essays, 2 or 3 page articles on something. And usually I can tell within the first 2 or 3 paragraphs whether it's worth finishing.
Right.
You know, it's
worth the squeeze. Yeah.
Was all the value in the headline, and there's no value in the actual text. But the interesting thing is that I find myself kind of unfazed by what a lot of people are reporting to me. They're noticing about the pandemic, they're noticing, you know, about television and everything like that. And you know, so, you know, when the riots started, people started saying the riots, did you see the riots? And I said, riots. So I went to Wikipedia and I went to Google and the history of great riots, periods of great riots. And I started reading the history of riots. And actually, you know, I lived through the end of the 60s and early 70s when there were massive riots in the United States starting 68 with the, you know, 68, there was, you know, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And then there was the big, big riots in Chicago, the Democratic National Convention. And then it was going forward. And I said, you know, what I'm being told doesn't, you know, it's kind of, I've already seen that. And then I said, well, have there ever been other periods of great riots? And then I went back in the 1880s and 1890s, just way bigger riots than we're having here, you know, and the biggest riot in the history of the United States was the New York riot opposing the draft into the Union Army during the...
oh, really? Wow.
Civil War. Yes, 300 or 400 people were killed in New York City. It was a New York City riot. You know, and massive blocks were burned down. Massive blocks were burned down. And you're talking about, you know, a riot that big against a much smaller population, you know. You know, and so it was a really big deal. So I came away and I said, That's right. When I say I knew, I've got a historical context for riots that I hadn't, you know, and it ebbs and flows. And, you know, it has a lot to do with the introduction of new technology into society. Yeah. So I said, you know, have a lot of new technology changing things, probably you're going to get riots.
Yeah, I think, and what do you think that is? Like just the uncertainty that people have?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is the disruption to normal life. The technology will introduce disruptions and it can eliminate employment in certain occupations with no thought of what's going to happen to the people who are unemployed. The big one in the 1870s and 1880s was the pretty well the complete destruction of the agricultural economy, which more or less employed in some way connected to it, you know, more than half the working population of the United States.
Well, that was thanks to Cyrus McCormick.
Well, Cyrus McCormick and 100 other things that got inspired by Cyrus, you know, the cotton gin, actually.
Mechanization, right.
Cotton gin in the South actually kept slavery going probably for 20 years further and then caused a massive war. That I would consider a war a riot. You know, seems to me like the first World
that's
War.
The modern,
And
you think you look at Chaz. You know, that was really had all the markings of war in a way, right? The taking of territory and the fortressing and
They had the skills of taking. They didn't have the skills of governing.
Right, exactly.
Skills of that requires a different kind of training, actually. The skills of governing require an added skill level beyond taking.
I always think about that Milton Friedman on Phil Donahue saying to Phil
that
Donahue,
was a great.
Where do you propose to find these angels to come down and organize society without regard to self-interest? I don't even trust you to do that, Phil. Which was just so beautiful. I don't even trust you to do that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And, you know, his feet not even reaching the floor. You know, I mean, he's a little... He's a little guy. Anyway, that's straight from the Federalist Papers. James Madison said, you know, ideally we would like, society to be run by virtuous people, but, who have other people's interests at heart. He says, ideally we do that. But if we had that, we probably wouldn't need the government because things would just get taken care of. And so our research kind of indicates that these virtuous people who think about others aren't in large supply, but ambitious people who think about their own self-interests are in very large supply. So why don't we build the government on making the ambition of individuals actually create something that creates good for everybody? That's the trick here. That's the trick here that we have to create. We have to channel individual ambition into activities which actually benefit way more than them.
But I think the difference now that what we have is there are virtually no filters between or bafflers of ambition and somebody's desire to get ahead, that it's much easier. Yeah. To tap into a meritocracy in a way where you can, I just realized I was having this conversation with Philip the other day that I mentioned to you, we've been, you know, teaching him how to set up an eBay business to, mm-hmm. so, and, what I realized, you know, he's made the first sales on there, and I realized that he's got the key to self-sufficiency right now there. Yeah. Anything he could possibly want. I actually shot him a video for his 22-year-old self while he was there. And, you know, given, because he's so, it's all about the video games and only doing what he has to do right now, you know? And I made the video with him there for his 22-year-old self, and I showed him there. And I said, wherever you are right now, whatever you have, look around you. It's 100% because of the decisions that this guy right here made for you today. And and that whole thing, I said to Philip, I'm just trying to get him excited that, you know, we're actually going to read Wanting What You Want as part of this thing, because I've been going through the four habits of showing up on time, do what you say you're going to do, finish what you start, say please and thank you as 80% of the keys to life. And now couple that with control of your own umbilical cord that you don't need to run around looking for somewhere to plug it in. You could plug it into to cloud landing.
Your head. You can plug it into your head.
Yes, exactly. And so you look at it that the opportunities for anybody with ambition and a cell phone, I mean, there's so much opportunity to tap into the ability to trade your time or your skills or your abilities or your goods and services.
Yeah. The interesting thing is the meritocracy, you know, this became a big deal. I think it was after the Second World War, especially, you know, that we're going to bring meritocracy rather than being born into the right family. You know, it's a break with the past in the sense that, you know, all the empires that were basically a matter of family, you know, that if you were born into certain families, whoever the key person was in society, then their children would be born to inherit the key person role. And then there were all the people who benefit from the key role, the aristocracy. And it was generally a pushback and say, you know, we've tried this whole, you know, depending on birth of most important people to sort of determine the future of our society. We're going to make it open to anybody. But the truth of it is that meritocracy itself only favors certain types of skills. Okay. Mm-hmm. And one of the big skills is the skill of taking an SAT test and getting into the right university. It favors those skills. Okay. It favors those skills. And so much so that the people who were the educators started to make sure that their children were at the head of the line for the SAT test. So what we've been dominated more and more with is an educator-based meritocracy. And they always said that if you got a college education, no matter how much you paid for it, it would amortize itself in income over the course of your lifetime. Uh-huh. But that got broken. That got broken sort of in the as a result of the Great Recession, 2008-2009. That you could have spent $200,000, you know, on your education, or your parents could have, and you know, 10 years later, you're saying, "Will that be with fries?"
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yes.
Yeah. Welcome to Walmart. You know, welcome to Walmart. That it had become interesting, but one group of people really took advantage of that meritocracy thing. That was people who were education minded. Okay, and the thing that I see here is that what they hate is that someone's going to bypass their complete system, you know, like the junior kindergarten through to graduate school, that somebody's going to come along and just bypass that whole system who just has a bright idea, like Philip. Philip just has a bright idea. And over the next 10 years, you know, if he stays with the lesson that he's learned with his first eBay experience, he may come up with something really, really big that is at this point totally unpredictable, and it could be very, very disruptive to people who are busily on their junior kindergarten to graduate school line, and they're going to come out, and something that Philip creates actually makes all their efforts to get to the top the normal way worthless.
Boy, isn't that something? I mean, even because, well, school, everything about school is being questioned. This is going to be a renaissance for that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. I mean, there's such a gap right now for, and an opportunity for, you know, rethinking that whole education process.
Yeah. Well, the big mistake I always felt, and it goes for healthcare too, that there was such a thing as a healthcare system and there was such a thing as an educational system. And I kept, you know, over the years saying, well, where's the system? Where's the system? Does the system have an address? Does the system have a phone number? Does the system have a, you know, does the system have a website? And I thought, I can't find the system. Where is the system?
Right.
But I can see hundreds of thousands of different little systems, some of them good, some of them terrible, and you know, there's no system. You know, this whole notion of a system is an industrial concept. It's it doesn't have any. It's like the Google system. Well, what is it? Is there a Google system? I mean, there's a capability that people use in a million different ways.
Yeah,
They're making money by creating a capability that a lot of people can use any which way. But there isn't any system. You know, I doubt if the creators of Google have any comprehension what their system is.
Wow. Well, it's I watched, there's a documentary now called the, I think it's called The Social Dilemma, and it's on.
Yeah. It's really made the rounds. I've heard it 20 times over the last.
Pretty fascinating. I mean, you know, the premise. One of the things that was really what stuck out for me was when they said people are fear that what's it going to be like when AI is more powerful than human intelligence, kind of thing, at our best. And these guys said, well, that's not the real fear. The real fear is when AI is more powerful than the human weakness, which is true right now. And AI really is ruling things because of that weakness. And all of that, the way they illustrated and showed that Facebook and Google and things are, you know, showing you things and notifying you about things and keeping you in that app. They want you looking at that screen so they can auction off that attention.
Can I ask you a question though? Is that true for you?
I do see parts of it for sure. I mean,
you see parts of it, but do they have control over your attention?
I would say that I would go through withdrawal. I don't know that they control me because I'm probably in that situation of saying, oh, I could quit at any time kind of thing, right? I'm definitely, let's say, if we're talking about dopamine as alcohol and...
Yeah.
I drink every day. I'm a daily drinker. But I like to think, well, I could stop at any time. I'm a social drinker, or it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. But there's probably a huge opportunity cost of it.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, I definitely notice those. I'm definitely in the grips of automatic behavior, which includes never being more than arm's length from my phone, or, you know, there's a lot of time that I'm on there, but I kind of, you know, justify it in a way, put a dignified wrapper on it of, well, that's how I make I get my best ideas, by being on the forefront. How else do you think I know about Kylie Jenner and Lil Nas X? And those stimulate the bigger thoughts of how that applies. So I like to think of myself as in it, but not of it, you know?
Well, here's the thing, you know, I mean, and it's a conversation that I have with the high technology people, you know, because they're predicting exactly the future that the social dilemmas thesis is about the whole point. And it's a thought for, you know, the next Welcome to Cloudlandia. I think all the, you know, big data, all artificial intelligence is really, really fast computation. You know, it's just really fast computation. Okay. Uh-huh. And it only has as a diet the data of things that have already happened.
Yes.
It has no predictive power whatsoever. Okay. If you choose, for example, I doubt if they, well, you know, I've been conversing with you for a decade, or, you know, in a very steady way. And I doubt if all the new ideas that you've had in your use of input, you know, input from, let's say, Cloudlandia, were any of them more predictable. I don't think any of them were predictable.
No, but the behaviors that's not, part of it is not about predicting what the outcome is going to happen. But I think it's an AI. We're observing us and our data usage and our geo positioning, that it would be very predictable to think that next Sunday at 11 a.m., I'm going to be sitting at 103 degrees north, .32.76, whatever the meets and bounds are for where I am. And you're going to be sitting where you are, and we're going to be connected on Uber conference. That would be predictive.
But they haven't at all interfered with our conversation or tried to.
No, not at all.
During our conversation. So here, I mean, this is just for thinking. The other thing is, there isn't one AI system. There's going to be millions, and they're all going to be competing with each other.
Yeah.
You know, they're all going to be, these are nervous, whoever these AI systems are, they're very nervous systems. They're feeling very, very threatened because some other AI system is going to take away their attention thing. So what I'm saying there is that there's no human mastermind behind any of this.
Oh, right. That's exactly. Yes, I agree with you 100%.
Capabilities. I mean, if you want to see somebody imprisoned and feeling totally captured by the future, it's whoever is the highest person in one of these AI firms.
Mm.
They're just desperate that they're going to be rendered obsolete by somebody else's AI system.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. I find these.
You and I and the folks we hang out with, we lead incredibly free, relaxed lives compared to those folks.
That's true. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I find these conversations are endlessly fascinating and motivating.
Yes, they are. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's all that's required, two characteristics, endless and fascinating.
That's exactly right.
All right.
Boy.
Dean, see you next Sunday.
Thanks, Ted. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.